Today's Taisho will be on case 48 from the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 48 is entitled Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to Nirvana. I still wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, the rain comes down in torrents." Mumon's comment: one, going to the bottom of the sea, lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road. Mumon's verse, "Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret." Once again, I want to thank everybody for doing an absolutely superb job this morning. I must say that the sitting in the room this morning I was very moved by it. Everybody is doing such a wonderful job. People sat so still, and there was such deep stillness, such deep samadhi in this room. It was quite moving. I consider it, undeserved good fortune to be able to practice with each of you. It's really just wonderful. Somebody came to Sashin this time after being away and not practicing as much as that person would have liked. You know, sometimes we get caught up in things and we don't always have a chance to practice. I understand that can happen. But the person, chose to come here, even though maybe not as prepared as he might have been. And there's always for somebody like that, going to Sashin is a real struggle. It's a real struggle. I mean, in our Zen practice, we've built in a little series of graduated steps. So you can come on Monday night, and you're sitting for 15 minutes, and you're thinking, "Oh man, when is this going to end?" And you get to the point where you can do 25 minutes, and you can do half an hour, or 35 minutes, and so on. And then you go to the Thursday night sit, and you can do an hour and a half with some little breaks, and then you come to Saturday sit, and finally, if you're practicing regularly, you come to Sashin. But if you haven't been practicing regularly, Sashin is really a challenge, right? And now please don't think that I'm criticizing this person, not at all. What I'm saying is that this person's, it's very moving to see somebody with that kind of dedication, where there's a kind of person who just gets a message in your heart that says, you know, go to Sashin, you know, and basically, you know, you just get up and you go to Sashin, and you know it's going to be hard. It might even be murder, you know, but you do it because something deep in yourself said to go. And I just think that's a very beautiful fact, and I'm honored that you know, such a person is here practicing with us today. You know, that must be, hang in there, please, my friend. It's you know, difficult. There are people who are here for like second or third session, and you know, I have to say that. When I went to my first session, it was murder, right? You know, murder. I mean, I just don't know how I got through it, but it was just a blur, right? And when it was done, I thought, well, I'm never doing that again. But then, you know, I went to the next one. You know, something in me said go, you know, and I went. I got up and I went. But you know, I had thought that the second session would be easier than the first, but it wasn't, you know. And then I went to another one, and 30 years later I'm still going. But it does get easier. Please believe me, it gets a lot easier. I talk about the fact that I have pain, but believe me, it's heaven, you know. Nobody would do this for 30 years if it was about pain. It's not. It's about being in heaven. Some people are here for the second or third session, and that's like, you know, the first session, everything is novel and interesting, and you think, well, now this is something different, you know, this is strange, you know, and it's a challenge, but you know, you think, well, you know, this is my first session, it's going to be tough. But when you come back for two or three, you realize, whoa, you know, whoa, what have I signed up for, you know? And so then you begin to see, it's like you see the long road ahead, right? You know? The long road. Yes. And it is. I'm not going to. Anybody who tells you that, there are these people in the United States who, sell a kind of instant enlightenment, you know, and they're just not honest. You know, this takes a long time. You know, it takes a long time to cultivate a big mind. And integrate it into your life. It takes many sessions. And you can go as far as you want, or, you know, I mean, I hope you'll understand that if you don't want to make this your life's work, I understand. You know, if you want to come to a couple of sessions and say, hey, I did that, it was interesting, thank you. And that's fine with me. And if you want to just come and sit on the week, during the weekdays, that's fine with me. You won't hurt my feelings. And believe me, if I see you on the street, you know, there's this woman named Jamie who was sitting with us for about a year. And I was going across College Avenue campus. She stopped sitting. And I was going across College Avenue campus and I saw her and I said, hey, Jamie. And she looked like I was going to yell at her. Like, why aren't you in Zazen? You know? You know? Where have you been, young lady? And I said, how's it going? You know? And I think she was genuinely surprised. But, you know, I understand that different people want to lead different kinds of lives, you know? And so, you know, basically I didn't raise the issue of Zen at all with her. She finally said, listen, I am coming back, you know. And I said, you know, don't worry about it. You know, if you come back, wonderful. And if you don't come back, that's wonderful too, you know. This is your practice, you know. Anyway, you know, if you decide this is not your cup of tea, you're not going to hell, you know. That's not, or you might, but it won't because you quit zazen, you know. But if you want to do this, if you want to do this, I think I can't tell you how grateful I am for this beautiful path. That, you know, this morning, you know, I just had a very wonderful sit. And, you know, I get off the cushion sometime and I just feel like crying with gratitude just to be alive, you know. And that might seem trivial, but many people, you know, and myself included, a lot of time, you know, life just isn't good enough, you know. This life just, if you think about it, you know, we're probably trashing the planet, you know. I mean, I don't want to bring people down, but have you noticed it's a little warm this morning? You know, we're probably trashing the planet. And you have to say there's a tragic dimension to that, right? Because, you know, the world is just as it was the day a Homo sapien stumbled onto the stage of history, was really a wonderful place. You know, really a wonderful place. I remember reading a Lakota Indian, and there was a biography of a Lakota Indian, and he lived out on the plains of the American West. And he said, you know, I never understood why white people called it the Wild West. It never seemed wild to us. It seemed like the most beautiful place. Yeah? So, you know, there's something fundamentally good, I think, about the world, you know, something. It's been fundamentally good long before we arrived on the stage of evolution. And maybe when we're gone, definitely when we're gone, it will still be fundamentally good, you know. So basically, you know, we are trashing the planet because we just don't think it's good enough for us. Yeah, it's just not good enough. And so we're going to remake it because, you know, we know better. And many people who do this, by the way, have very good intentions. I was talking about the fact that the Tata Motor Company, the biggest industrial company in India, a real giant, has come out with an affordable car, right? And it's a little tiny car. It looks like Americans make some cars that are very small like this, but it's a $2,000 or $2,500 car, which is still a lot of money for about 3 billion people on Earth, but who make less than a dollar a day. But it's a significant achievement to make a car. And of course, we all drove here in our cars, and there's a kind of snobbery, right, about saying people in India shouldn't be able to drive a car too. But on the other hand, as the temperature heats up, you know, the last thing we need is more cars, you know, really. So anyway, where am I going with this? My point is that I think it's good for me personally sometime when I'm unhappy with life to just be grateful for the sheer fact of being alive, you know? And being a human being, I am very picky. And I say, this is not good enough for me. This day is not good enough for me. This job is not good enough for me. This house is not good enough for me. This car is not good enough for me. And what a poor little boy I am, you know? Because I deserve everything, and I've gotten this raw deal from the universe. But then I come and I do zazen for a couple days, and it's not a heavy price to pay. And I sit on the cushion, and it's like being in heaven. It's just heaven. And I feel so grateful to be alive. See, and this in Buddhism, this experience of the being grateful for the sheer presence of the world. This is we talked about this yesterday. It's called Tathagata, thusness. Yeah. In Western tradition, there's a phrase that expresses this too. It's called "Thy will be done." Yeah. And so a lot of Zen practice is learning to be grateful for the sheer, you know, not learning to be less picky about life. And man, if we can be less picky about life, life is so good. It's so beautiful. It's such a great opportunity. Yeah? It's inestimably wonderful, you know. So anyway, if you're do you have the watch? Oh, here it is. I just, without a watch, could get bad, you know. I'm sure you want me to watch the time. I could go on for a long time, so. So, for those of you who are, you know, a lot of people have struggled to be here. They've had to make personal sacrifices, lost wages and things like that. And then being here is a struggle, you know. Some of you have health problems and yet here you are, you know, at the sesshin. And it's you know, very deeply moved, and I hope you you know, if you practice with diligence, you know, we're all sort of headstrong people. You know, we're all headstrong. You know, we want it our way. You know, have it your way. There's a commercial that says have it your way. You know, with pickles and everything. You know, that's how we want life. You know. The odd thing is that, you know, when you always have it your way, it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily produce a good heart, you know, it doesn't necessarily produce a compassionate person. And when we don't have it our way, we have to live a deeper life. You have to live a deeper life. You know, we are very good at, we can say to this mountain, be moved, and we can move it, literally. You know, we have bulldozers and everything. But this is the modern world. We're very good at making things. There's a bunch of trees, and we cut them down, we put a parking lot, we put a McDonald's, and we're very good at that. You know, we're perhaps less good at what do you do when you can't change, you can't control things. See, because my feeling is that I don't think we can control things. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to do good in the world, absolutely, but I think that the way we often go about doing good in the world can be very destructive, you know. We think we can change things, right? We're not always sensitive to the results of the changes we make, because our minds are too small. You know, our minds are too small. And we are sometimes willing to sacrifice all kinds of things for our big ideas and our high ideals. You know, there's a wonderful story. There's a long poem that probably nobody in the United States this year has read, and that's okay with me. It's called Faust. It's by a German poet, and this guy is trying to live a meaningful life, and he keeps screwing up, over and over again. You know, he has these good intentions, and they have bad results a lot of the time, unintended results. And basically, toward the end of his life, he decides that he's going to help humankind, and he decides he's going to drain this swampy area, and build like a shopping center or something. It's not really a shopping center. So he sends out his assistants, and anyway, he later learns that the swamp was the home to a bunch of poor people who lived off of the products of the swamp. And that to build his shopping center, his henchmen, unknown to him, ran them off, these old people who were living there. And so he thinks, oh my God, I've done it again. You know, I meant to do good, but I wound up screwing people over, you know. Anyway, one way to live your life is to try to start with that experience of gratitude and loving kindness, yeah. And that's really what that's one way of understanding what Zen is all about. That people are fundamentally Buddha, fundamentally compassionate, fundamentally loving. But we have never managed to create a way of life that's equal to our true nature as human beings. We have many different cultures, but if you look at history, you see that they're all very destructive, actually, without exception. So it's like we can't manage to come up with a way of life that's equal to our best selves, you know. So what we do here in the Zen world is take it sort of back to square one, or even back farther than that, back to zero. You know, and we sit on the cushion and we sort of like decondition the mind. You know, one way to think about what we're doing is deconditioning the mind. This is what you could, one way to think about Mu Xin, for example, you know. You're going back to the basic experience of being aware in this moment, with very few assumptions or presuppositions or expectations or judgment. This is really quite remarkable, because if you can just stay in the moment long enough, ordinary things become quite beautiful and wonderful, and the occasion for great love and gratitude. And also people become the same thing, you know. When you're on the freeway, when you're on the turnpike in New Jersey, you don't have to look far to see hostility, you know. And it's sort of like it's a common thing, you know. Driving down the turnpike is a competitive activity in a certain way. It's cooperative, but it's also competitive, you know. And people are trying to jostle their way into this and get to their destination in time and so on. So the system encourages them to be a little bit aggressive. But, you know, we come in here and we sit on the cushion for 3 days, and somebody comes into Dokusan and says, you know, I just feel like I love all of these people. You know, this Zen might not be your cup of tea, but I think there's something about this practice which is very profound, very powerful. You're taking it back to zero, and you suddenly realize, you know, I'm so glad that there are other people in the world, and I'm so glad they're different from me, you know, and I'm just so glad they're here, you know. And that seems, again, like kind of a trivial thing, but wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody, you know, really did have this, you know, got up in the morning and said, man, what a beautiful world. These trees are just beautiful. I don't think I'll cut them down after all, you know. and said, you know, maybe we don't need that road through here because, you know, living creatures make their homes here in these woods. Maybe there's another way. Maybe I don't need a bigger house, you know, maybe, you know. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you were driving down the turnpike and everybody's waving to you? You know, I am so glad you're here. You know, I'm so glad. No, that would be great, wouldn't it? It would be, what a wonderful world. And it's, you can't, see, you can't tell people, be compassionate, goddammit. You can't give them a rule. You can't say, rule number one around here is you're going to be compassionate, right? You know? You can write down laws like that, but, I mean, they don't work. They don't work. You know, you can't, or, it's like if you have problems with being, like, some people have problems with anger. You know, if you have an anger problem, you can't just say, now don't get angry, you know? That doesn't work, right? If you have like a flashpoint temper, you can't just sort of grind it out, you know? You can't say, all right, now I'm not gonna get angry, I'm not gonna get angry, you know? You find that anger occurs before you can control it or even realize that you're angry, right? So, you know, our responses, sort of neurotic responses are deeply ingrained, and they're not susceptible to that kind of rational control, you know. And in fact, this is part of our problem, right? I mean, we think this is like a rational society, but we do all kinds of crazy things as a society all the time. Because you can't just say, be nice, you know, you can't, that doesn't work. And it doesn't work for you individually. If you say, I have got to be more patient. Why is it taking me so long to be patient? You know, it's not going to work. So, you know, laws, rules, don't work. You know, in my opinion, if the heart isn't, if the transformation, you have to transform yourself, your own heart, and if you can find compassion and love in your own heart, then you will behave compassionately and lovingly. And by the way, if you don't love yourself, it's going to be almost impossible to love others, you know. Because then your relationship with them is always always tainted, right? By all kinds of fears and attachments. If you feel desperately unlovable, the relations you have with other people may tend to be unwholesome relationships. And again, I think our culture preys on that. I think a consumer society is based upon making people feel desperately unlovable, you know, without the proper toothpaste or something like that. You know. So, anyway, I thought today there was real samadhi, real deep samadhi in this room. It was really wonderful. And please don't be discouraged by the long road, because it's not like it's a long, bitter slog and then at the end of it somewhere there's enlightenment. It's not like that. What happens instead is that, you know, you're sitting for 3 days and you have a lot of pain, and then you go outside and you suddenly feel like your spirits lift, and you feel like this sort of joy for no reason. You know, and maybe it only lasts a few minutes, and maybe it lasts for half an hour. But that's what we mean when we talk about kensho in Zen, enlightenment in Zen. It's like it means opening, an opening into a bigger life, bigger awareness. You might think, well, why the heck am I happy? You know, because my legs hurt, I'm tired, you know, I'm sick of rice, you know? But I'm so damn happy. What, for what reason? See, and there isn't a reason, right? There isn't really, things like happiness don't have reasons, in my opinion, really. I mean, because, you know, sometimes you can be happy and none of the conditions you have for happiness have been met by reality. Isn't that interesting? And sometimes all of the conditions have been met. Sunny day, you know, martini in hand, whatever, you know, whatever your idea of paradise is, you know, football game, whatever, you know. And yet you're miserable. You think, well, gee, the checklist is, I've checked all the items off and I'm still not happy. You know? Sometimes, you know, it's raining, you're wet and you're cold, you're lost, you get out of the car and, you know, sometimes it just happens. You look around and think, huh, being alive is the darndest thing. And I'm so happy to be alive. And that happens a lot on the cushion. So, the koan, now to the koan. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, Osho means priest, it is written, there are Bhagavats, or like blessed ones, or you could think of them as enlightened ones or something, Bhagavats in the 10 directions. In other words, in Indian and Asian thinking, generally there are 10 directions, right? The 10 directions. The north, east, south, and then the subdivisions, and also up and down. So there's 10 directions, okay? He says, there's Bhagavats. There, in every direction I see a great teacher. See, I see Jesus, I see Moses, I see Muhammad, I see Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh, maybe. I see, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, I see the Dalai Lama, you know, I see Sitting Bull. Okay, there's Bhagavats in the 10 directions, but one straight road to Nirvana. It's like, which road do I pick? See? There's so many of these different ways to live, you know, which is the right way to live? And this is a very significant question, right? I mean, one of the reasons we have so much conflict in our world today is that all these different cultures are coming together and they have different systems of value, right? Some cultures say it's perfectly okay to go to the beach in a bikini, right? In fact, what would you wear if you weren't wearing a bikini or something? And some cultures think of that as like, it's time for like war, you know? You can say, well, how small-minded of them, but, their teachings, their way of life says, no, you don't go to the beach in a bikini. That's absolutely evil, right? And that must never be done, you know? Some people say it's absolutely immoral to lend money for interest. Do you know that? If you're an American, you might find that hard to believe. But there are some cultures that say it's absolutely immoral to lend money. If you give somebody money, it has to be a gift. You're exploiting somebody if you give them money and you say, and I'll get that 15% or 22% on your credit card. That's evil, see. And Americans think evil, you know, this is the most, credit is the most wonderful thing in the world, and you can make a case for that. You know, so there's many different ways to live, and there's many different, some people think this is good, and some people, so how do you know, right? How do you know? And basically, the Zen approach is to say, laws don't do any good if the heart isn't already purified, you know? And basically, the teachings of Buddha and Moses and Jesus, none of these are going to, can make people good. None of these can make people good, really. People have to cultivate goodness in themselves, and then they'll be Jesus. They'll be, you know, in other words, you'll see what they see, you know. The road you have to follow is your road in life, right? And only you can follow it, you know. You have to find goodness in yourself. You have to find compassion and gratitude in yourself. And then you have to make your life choices on the basis of that. Yeah? I mean, maybe you might believe that that maybe the answers lie in a holy book. You know, I myself have read the Bible maybe 7 times in my life, really. When I was little, when I was a kid, like 16, I actually tried to read the whole Bible. I understood like 2%, but I tried to read it, right? And I took courses on the Bible in college, and I've done a lot of reading on the Bible. But one thing I see very clearly is the Bible is a bundle of contradictions, right? You know, over here it says this, and over here it says this. So, you know, even, you know, you have, you know, we have the Constitution of the United States, you know. Even that people disagree about. You know, you can say it's written right down, just follow the Constitution, right? But basically, you have the Zen view, and it's not everybody's view, is that laws don't make people good. People have to cultivate goodness in their own hearts. And then, you know, you don't need the laws, see? Because the laws were designed to get you to this place. Now, you know, everything I say should be taken with a giant grain of salt, okay? Because first of all, remember, the teacher isn't the teacher formally. I'm running the sesshin, but the teacher is mushin, right? So this is my perspective on experiences that have happened to me on the cushion, okay? So feel free to reject everything I say if you want, and just keep practicing. I can help you with your practice, even if you think I'm a blowhard and I don't know anything. That's perfectly okay with me, because I'm at your service, right? That's my job. If I can help, I'm happy to help, you know, and there's no strings attached. All you have to do is follow the rules of the Zendo, and I'm happy, and I'm at your service. But my feeling is that this issue is, like, how do we live? How do we live our lives? And my feeling is that you can't really look to others, actually. That you have to find it in yourself. Because, you know, sometimes people do ask me for my opinion. You know, they're facing a crisis in their lives, and they'll come into Dokusan and say, you know, what should I do? I just don't know what to do. And we could get out all the scriptures, we could get out the Bible and say, well, you know, Abraham did this, maybe it's like Abraham. Or we could, you know, maybe this is what, you know, Arjuna did. You know, maybe you should be like Arjuna, you know, maybe. Or, you know, the prophet says this, you know. But I think we would agree that that's not very satisfying, you know. And I can't say, well, here, do this, because after all, I'm not going to face the consequences of your actions, right? I mean, basically, when you choose, you have to take the consequences, right? So the Zen way is, you know, basically, you know, you could come into Dokusan and I could say, well, the answer is obvious. Here's what Buddha would do, you know, and you could do it, you know, and then you could be miserable, and meanwhile, I could move to Florida, right? You know, I'm not planning to do that. But then you'd be stuck with the consequences of my decision, right? I think this, we were talking earlier about the Buddha saying that his is the path of freedom. And I think what he means is, you know, we make free choices. Since we're on the subject of choices, we make free choices. And we do it by taking our hearts and minds and bodies back to the zero point. And when compassion arises, when loving kindness arises, when the boundary between ourselves and others begins to fall away, we know what's the right thing to do. Okay? And basically, each of us has to make that decision for himself or herself. But if you work through these conflicts, and you have, if you come to sesshin and you have conflicts, and you have turmoil, and you work your way through, eventually, you know, you find a place that's very serene, And you have love in your heart, and you're calm, and then you know what you have to do. You know, you know. And it may not be a popular decision. You know, and it may not be a conventionally good decision, you know. But you know in your heart this is what you have to do. And how do you know you're not kidding yourself? Well, the ground floor is, as I said, this state of being in which you feel gratitude for the pure presence of existence, compassion and connectedness, right? And then you're ready to make your decision. And I think people who are like this have a kind of very valuable, they're very valuable to society, right? Because a whole society can just make a fatally stupid decision because nobody wants to deviate from what everybody thinks of as good. You know, I mean, a good example of this is like, you know, in Nazi Germany, you know, for years and years, you know, in German culture, the number one value is fulfilling your duty. This is like the top thing. You know, in German culture, duty is everything. Duty. You know, you put yourself aside and you serve a society. And that worked very well for like the Nazis, right? It was very unusual for a German to say, I'm not going to do this, my heart says this is rotten, I don't care if all of you are going to do it, I'm not going to do it, you know? There was a great Zen master named Hakuin Zenji. And Hakuin was this wonderful man, very compassionate. And he got up every day and he did Zazen ferociously. He loved Zen. And he used to, actually, this sounds crazy, and you don't have to do it. And I have to say, I never have. But he wanted to sit all the time, you know. So he used to actually have a little monk come in, and he had like a pulley. He would put a rope under his arms, right? And then the string went up over a beam, and there was a pulley, and then the monk would tie it to a peg on the wall so he couldn't fall over, right? He'd be sleeping in Zazen, right? Okay, and in the morning the little monk would come in, untie the thing, and then the rope would drop to the ground and Hakuin would go out and take a pee, you know? Okay, so, you know, that was Hakuin. But a deeply compassionate person. And at one point, Hakuin was sitting in the temple. He wasn't tied up like that. He was just doing the zazen without assistance of a rope. And this family came up to the temple, and it was a young girl with a baby, and a very angry father of the young girl who had the baby. And the father came right into the temple. And Hakuin, by the way, was one of the most deeply awakened people in Japan, and he had this seedy little temple. He could have run any temple he wanted to, but he just ran the temple that his teacher had bequeathed to him. It was, when he got there, the roof was leaking and stuff like that, you know, so there were buckets on the floor. But Hakuin fixed it up over the years and was just what you would say like a country monk, you know, simple parish priest, sort of. Anyway, this father came in and he said, my daughter has had a baby out of wedlock, and it's your baby. And Hakuin just said, oh, is that so? He didn't go, oh no, you've got me all wrong, you know, see? He didn't go, oh, please don't think that way about me. You've got me all wrong. I'm a good person. I'm a monk. You know, I tie myself to the ceiling every day. He didn't go, oh, that's so unfair. You're so unfair. He just said, is that so? And so then the father said, well, yes, Mr. Hakuin, and you're going to take this baby and you're going to take care of it. So Hakuin took the baby, and he took beautiful care of that baby. And he didn't know anything about taking care of babies, but he had friends in the village, women who practiced with him, and they helped him, and they all took care of the baby, and Akuin changed the baby, and everything, and this went on for like a month, right? And then the father came back, still pissed off, with the daughter, and now the daughter has this young kid with him too, this young guy. And the father said, "So, you know, he's the father, you're not the father." And Hawking said, "Oh, is that so? Right? Is that so?" And then the father said, "We're taking this baby back." And that's the end of the story, right? And Hawking didn't say, "Now you see, you know, you can see me for what I really am. You know, please respect me, you know, this is finally, you know." It's, you know, basically Hakuin has a different way of living, right? He dwells in compassion. He works diligently to be a compassionate person. He purifies body, mind, and heart. He gets up and he says, "Oh, I am so grateful to be in this beautiful world. I love you, I love you, I love you." See? And that's a different way of life, yeah? Hakuin is like if I may say, he's a lawless man. Right? There's different ways to be a lawless man or a lawless woman. We meet people who are lawless in a bad way, but this is a different kind of lawlessness, right? It's like no law is able to express No, there's no law humans have managed yet to write which is as good as compassion itself, as the Tathagata itself. Please purify body, mind, and heart. Not just at sesshin, but in every way you can, in your daily life too. And then you'll know when compassion arises, and love and connectedness, you'll know what to do, right? This is how we Zen people live. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think it's a beautiful way to live. Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret.